Today, of course, our subject is a most important one, one that we're all directed to by our daily newspapers. The question of race riots in England, and I think we can call them race riots. The question of the selection of Hendrik Verwoerd as Prime Minister of the Union of South Africa. Mr. Verwoerd is a leading racist. I think that these and what's going on in our own backyard in the South and in the North, these things all point to the importance of the question before us. Just before I introduce my guests, I'd like to point out that last week, or a little while ago at any rate, Senator Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas, put before the Supreme Court of the United States a brief as a friend of the court in the case of Little Rock. And he said in part this: "History tells us that race memories long endure. They are perpetuated in myths and monuments and a mother's lullaby. They are sentimental and emotional, and when stirred up, they become irrational. We are confronted here with a problem novel and unprecedented in the history of our country, and extraordinarily complex. In our congenital optimism, we Americans believe, or affect to believe, that social questions of the greatest difficulty may be solved through the discovery and the application of a sovereign remedy that will forever dispose of the problem. Yet all this flies in the face of human experience. Thus, for example, a so-called Jewish problem has endured for more than 2,000 years. The Roman Catholic Protestant problem has similarly endured since the Reformation, and one might add that the Islam Christian problem and the Hindu Muslim problem, among many others, plague various groups of men in this and in other countries. Millions of lives have been sacrificed to these problems, and the end is not yet." Well, in a sense, Senator Fulbright said this as a plea for what he would call moderation and for what others would call temporizing, and bad temporizing at that, in the situation that is going on in the South today. But I think it focuses our attention on the question of racism. Now let me introduce my guests who will discuss it themselves. My first guest is a man who's been very much in the forefront of the fight for rights of all groups in this country, Mr. Roy Wilkins, Executive Secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. My second guest is Dr. Hortense Powdermaker, Professor of Anthropology at Queen's College. And my third guest is Dr. Frederick Wortham, psychiatrist, director of the LaFog Clinic in Harlem, and author of Show of Violence and the Circle of Guilt, among other books and articles. I think that, Mr. Wilkins, I'd begin this program, and not by asking the tiny question and then building up to the important ones, but by taking the title of the program, The Roots of Racism, and turning it into a question and asking you what you think the roots of racism are.
Well, I was much interested in your quotation from Senator Fulbright's brief, which was offered but not accepted in the Supreme Court argument last week, and this age-old contention of the South that its problems are so complex and rooted in so much family and regional mythology that those who think they can solve them by passing a law or securing a court decision are deluded. I'm impressed by this argument only because it has been made by Southerners generation after generation with respect to any problem that has come up touching on the so-called race question. They made it during the slavery argument prior to the Civil War. They said that if you just let this thing alone, we'll solve it and slavery will disappear. It didn't disappear. And they said further after the Reconstruction period, if the North will let us alone, we will work out the Southern problem. They haven't worked it out. They say now in the face of court decisions, don't hurry us, give us time, we'll work it out. Don't try to pass a law, go to court, just let it work out. I don't think it'll work out that way. One of the roots of racism in this country has been the conviction in the South that it must maintain what I might call a separate nation, that it never lost anything at Appomattox, that what it did before Appomattox was right, and that the North and the rest of the world is wrong in telling them that they must reform. They don't intend to reform. And I think Little Rock and all the other things have evidence that they don't intend to reform.
Dr. Wortham, how do you react to this question of the roots of racism? As a psychoanalyst, do you look to the personal involvement?
Well, I would say there has been a great deal of discussion and talk about the psychological roots of race prejudice. And as a matter of fact, at the present time, Mr. Hefner, there are two schools. One is the Murdahl school, and the other school is the Cox school. Now, Dr. Murdahl wrote a famous book on American Dilemma, and he sees the roots of race prejudice psychologically. I think he's wrong. Because, first of all, it isn't an American dilemma. It's worldwide. And second, it isn't a dilemma. Because common decency is not a dilemma if you practice it. Now, Dr. Cox is a unknown, well-known professor of sociology at Tuskegee Institute. And he sees the roots of prejudice primarily socially. And of course, I can give you only one point in connection with the deepest social roots, and that is that at the present time, the average Negro family earns one-third of what a non-Negro family earns. Now, when Sander Fulbright talks about mythology, it would have been much better he would have talked about that. In other words, who profits from race prejudice? That is one of the fundamental problems, as far as I can see. Now, of course, there are psychological phenomena, too, but they are not basic.
What do you mean they're not basic?
Well, I mean, if race prejudice is so universal and so widely spread, we have to look for some real dynamic factors. What causes it? It isn't enough that a person, like they say now, is insecure and that therefore is prejudiced. We want to find out who profits from this. There must be some enormous motive. And of course, from this, people do profit.
Dr. Panamaker?
I would differ just slightly from Dr. Wertheim. In that this has to be an either-or thing in terms of roots. I think of racism as having many roots, and that some of the roots are psychological in nature. Some are social in nature, and some are what we anthropologists would call cultural in nature. And that in certain situations, one factor may be more important than another, but which can only be determined by considerable study. Now, I would just like to take up one of the points that you made in reading the small quotation from Senator Fulbright. He talked about racial memory. There is, from an anthropological point of view, no such thing as a racial memory. But there is, I think what he really meant was cultural traditions, that folklore, mythology, traditions, attitudes, points of view are handed down socially from one generation to another. And as an anthropologist, I would like to make the point that these are not innate. They are not handed down in our germplasm. Cultural behavior is learned behavior. And so what has been learned can be relearned. It can also sometimes be unlearned. And new behavior can be learned also. Yeah.
But in a sense, Mr. Wilkins says that in our own South, it hasn't been unlearned or relearned.
No, but there is this always this possibility. My point is an agreement with Mr. Wilkins that a new generation, which would be growing up in a new situation, might have a different kind of memory and a different kind of tradition.
Mr. Wilkins?
Yes, I think that's true, Dr. Powdermaker. But I'd like to point out, and I'm sure you recognize it as well, that we have had in this recent emotional discussion of Little Rock and the Supreme Court and the federal government and state authority some very curious revelations of the concept of the United States government, its ideals, its policies, by people in the South. I was greatly distressed during the University of Alabama case. A television program showed a student who said, well, I tell you, first I'm a citizen of Alabama and then of the United States. And yesterday's papers carried a story from a woman in Little Rock who said, the very idea of nine men handing down an opinion for the whole country. Now, you see, these are concepts of Alabama as a separate entity and of Arkansas as not a part of the country, but entitled to specialized consideration. And I would tend to believe that the whole educational process in the South, I would like to study the textbooks, and I'd like to see some of the syllabi, and I'd like to attend some of the lectures in the high schools and colleges of the South to see whether or not, and it's pretty evident it has not been, they have not tried to unlearn or relearn. They have embedded and re-embedded these old myths as history.
Are you saying then that, Mr. Wilkins, that this is not it's not innate, as Dr. Panamaker pointed out, but rather it's a national trait? It's an historical, cultural, national trait, and you're saying the South is a nation unto itself.
And that it has encouraged itself to be so, and it has never made an attempt to educate its people. That's the reason I think if we get rid of segregated schools, we'll do a favor to the white South as well as to the Negro South.
Yes, but if you say that, how then are you going to answer the question that's directed to the statement that you yourself have made, I'm sure, many times, that here in the North, throughout the North, and England now, we find manifestations of racism, where there is no national heritage, where there is no even regional or sectional heritage of racism. It pops up. Why?
Part of Dr. Wertheim's previous point, that there are certain groups of people who can profitably use racism, just as at the moment they are using statism or state rights or state being different and don't southern states not having to obey the rules of the Supreme Court. It seems to me that these ideas of that Alabama is greater than the Supreme Court or the United States or anything else, are whipped up by people who find it profitable to use these concepts in order to promote racism.
Profitable how? Emotionally, materially?
Well, I know Little Rock only by the newspaper accounts, which I read in great detail, and after all, the governor there was running for a third term and might have found it profitable to have used this issue.
Yes, but you're talking about the man who uses it, just as in the case of the Old South, one would talk about that very tiny percentage of wealthy, large slave-owning and plantation-owning Southerners who use the pro-slavery argument. But what about those beneath them who accepted the argument? Those who voted for Governor Forbes.
Yes, but the governor was their leader, and he made them respectable. That is, he said, you are right. I mean,
but
instead
how did,
of just having a bunch of hooligans.
I think this is a most important question that lay people would want to know. How does it profit an individual to accept these racist or racist
Two
ideas?
Words. Two what? Words. Cheap labor. Very simple.
Simple as all that?
Of course. That is the basic thing. You see, I agree with Mr. Wilkins and Dr. Powdermaker on almost anything. But I feel that all these arguments that they give down the South, they're only rationalizations about states' rights. That's all phony. And I think I can prove it because a case, a very bad case, which is not generally known, happened in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, as you know, they have the Girard College, which is a wonderful educational institution. So a man, I make it very brief, a man made a will in 1831 that this institution should only be for poor white orphans. And the city of Philadelphia has challenged this now, and they wanted, of course, to have everybody admitted. And that affects very many pupils, 1,100, as a matter of fact. So now they say they did exactly what the South did, just as dishonestly. They say now that Girard College is a private institution. And this is the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, not Governor Forbes. This is the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. It says they're a private institution. Now, I've checked that up. When I found out during the last 100 years, there have been no less than 53 government laws covering this institution. This is a public institution.
You would concede, Dr. Wertheim, that the lawyers on the court might have their precedence, too.
No, there's no precedent for that. That was a unique case.
If there's a precedent,
then it's a rationalization. I mean, here's a public institution, and they say it's a private institution. I think it is just as outrageous as the Southern one. And I think that this hypocritical race prejudice is something so serious that if you want to understand the roots of prejudice, you have to understand it.
Yes, but if you people talk about economics, and Dr. Powdermaker talks about politics, aren't you talking about the leaders and the motives that they have? Why did the poor whites, who certainly weren't
suckers.
Well off under...
They're suckers. They fall for it.
You think there's just naivete, Dr. Wertheim?
More than that, it's stupidity and prejudice and all kinds of other things.
What about frustrations, too?
All kinds of things. People believe what they're told. Look, I'll give you one example. Let's speak about New York City for a moment.
Yeah?
I would like to ask...
Yeah, we usually
Wilkins,
talk just about England or the South.
I just want to ask
home.
A word about New York City. Yeah. I don't want an answer, but I just want to ask you a rhetorical question. How many pupils do you think right now, as we're sitting here in New York City, go to school in some kind of segregation? How many? Do you think over 100,000 right now at this moment. Over 100,000, right? Over 100,000.
For economic reasons?
Well, I don't know, not individual. You see, after all, you establish in general that a race is a lower race and then you abuse them. I don't say in each school they profit. But look, if that happens in 100,000 pupils right now, and I just want to explain it in case I'm misunderstood, they either go to schools which are completely integrated, that means 99% or 100% Negro, or they do something which is even more diabolical, and I use the word advisedly, they go to a school which is integrated, apparently, you see, and actually they are sent to segregated classrooms. And this is done in such an underhanded way that nobody, and I address myself now to the hearers, to the listeners of this program, nobody knows about that because the Board of Education and the authorities keep that completely secret.
Well, maybe this
but
is
this
a subject
is an enormous
for, maybe this is a subject for another open mind.
Now, if you say the roots of prejudice, you have to find out why does the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court does it? They are not Southerners. They are not ignorant. Why does the Board of Education do that? They are not ignorant.
Well,
there must be a deep reason.
Put a word in, frustration. I think you weren't talking about economics.
Yes and no, partly economic. That is, when you referred to the poor whites. Now, the poor whites have been, for many centuries, economically frustrated. Obviously, they don't want to see Negroes get ahead of them, as many of them might if they were given equal opportunity. That is, given equal opportunity, the better people would just rise to the upper levels, and the people who were not would not.
But does this presume, and I'd ask Mr. Wilkins this, don't you think that this sort of presumes that the manifestations of racism before the Civil War in the South and now in the South and the North actually results in the economic well-being or the economic benefit of the white, when it seems to me that you've said, and a good many other people who are expert in this field have said, that racism in all of its forms destroys us all, and that there really is no economic benefit from it. Am I misquoting you, or am I misstating your position?
No, there is no permanent economic benefit from it, but it's not to be questioned that some does result. I've been searching in my mind, Dr. Wortham, for any connection between your maintenance of cheap labor and the underlying economic motivation and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and I'm unable to find any connection there, except as we stretch it tenuously to cover the philosophy of the protection of property and the inviolability of a man's disposing of his goods via his will as he sees fit. And in a society which is dedicated to the maintenance of property values and property rights over and above every other value and right, we can understand the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that the man who established Girard College had a right to set up such conditions as he saw fit, and that the state, insofar as the state injected itself, had a right to respect the terms of that will. After all, this is protecting the sacred rights of property. And I would hesitate to ascribe those actions and those rulings, no matter how many there might be over how many years, solely to prejudice akin to the prejudice in Alabama or Mississippi.
Well, let me ask Mr. Wilkins this question. How do you see the way out of the racism that is expressed in the South? And I don't think we can ignore the racism that is expressed now in England. What is the way out?
Oh, not at all. We can't ignore England, and I think this probably is more inexplicable than our own South. Some of the English commentators, for example, have thrown out the theory that the British West Indians who have come in there are actually threats, economic competition to the white British workers. They point to the fact that there is no dearth of jobs, that the Negroes have not taken away any jobs from white Englishmen. There is probably a conflict over housing and over the subject that very few people like to discuss out in the open, and that is the association of British white girls with the incoming Negro Jamaicans. And this, I think, has something to do with the English picture.
I'd like to answer.
Maybe I should say yes, go ahead, but let me get back to this other question and just see what Mr. Wilkins has to say about that. What is the way out?
Well, of course, we believe in the long way out. It's a terrific job of gradually bringing what might be called, and I think Dr. Powdermaker in one of her books and maybe her lectures has called the existence of a subculture in the South, the bringing of that subculture up to, God forbid, and all of its ramifications, the culture which is not sub, or at least not so regarded. In other words, we've got to bring the South up. Now, I don't mean in the missionary sense at all. We Negroes, of course, have a peculiar, personal stake in this whole thing because we're in the middle of this struggle between states and the federal government, between a subculture and an outside culture, between a conflict and rejection of ideas from the North, and our fate in the middle.
Could I make a point on this?
Dr. Panaway.
I don't think there is any one way out. And going back to this original statement, problems, social problems, since mankind is not perfect, will probably always be with us. But they do change, and they change enormous. The problem of anti-Semitism and of anti-Negro feeling is not the same today as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And so the problem is not some quick magical formula by which we get rid of this thing immediately. The problem is it's changing the nature of the problem itself. Actually, we have a very different problem today than what we had at the end of the Civil War. I would say the problem is on a higher level. If you are trying to get people to go to non-segregated schools, a different thing than trying to free them from slaves. And that is progress, in my estimation.
Well, that's a little bit like what Senator Fulbright said here when he went on further and said, I would suggest then that the problem of school integration in Arkansas is more likely, bearing in mind that flesh and blood is weak and frail, to yield to the slow conversion of the human heart than to the remedies of a more urgent nature, which seems to put
the point is this.
No?
I agree that human nature is not perfect and so forth and so on, but I think one can do very positive things and take a certain kind of leadership in making these changes, that one shouldn't just wait for the you cannot just wait for change to happen by itself. Because, as Dr. Wertham mentioned, the people who are for the status quo have something to gain from it. And therefore, if they are in power, it is a very, on this route and on the way out, it is very seldom have people with power given it up voluntarily. And if, because of the color of your skin, you enjoy political, social, educational, and economic advantages, you are not apt to just, out of the goodness of your heart, give up this advantage. And therefore, I would like to make the point that the fact that we have some violence, that we have some troubles, seems to me to be normal. I would say it was a miracle if we could have a drastic social change without some troubles accompanying it.
Dr.
But I say it's worth the trouble.
Dr. Wertham?
Well, I would say in general,
we have about, three
about this
left.
Whole problem of Little Rock, we are much too complacent, much too quiet. What has been done in the North, there are some very decent Southerners who'd like to do something. Have we helped them? Have we protested? We haven't done anything. Very little. As we discussed that as if it was far away in the moment. That's one thing. The second thing is, when I say economic problem, I don't mean that somebody profits immediately. But if I go back to the Girard College, for 100 years now, colored orphans have been deprived of education. In other words, they can't become radio commentators or doctors or nuclear physicists. They have to be handyman. And in 100 years, that's a lot of things. And secondly, when they say states' rights is involved, I think I can disprove it. Because supposing this Mr. Girard had made a will and said he forbids that he wants only children admitted who will not have injections against any infectious disease. Don't you think now with polio that they would have said, look, this will doesn't count because it was made 100 years ago, it's out of date, we change it. But just because it is something which somehow or other, we still want to continue. You see,
well,
I believe that we don't really stand up on anti shocking things that happen in Little Rock.
Well, let me ask Mr. Wilkins, as we end the program, whether he feels that there is any similarity between the position you just took and what Mr. Fulbright said here.
Well, we agree only about this far down the road, that's all. Because the South rejects what I believe in, namely the stimulation by means of legislation and by means of court action, by means of protest, by means of active political campaigning. They reject all that, whereas I subscribe to it. I'm with Dr. Powdermaker. I don't believe in waiting with Senator Fulbright for these things to happen out of the human heart. You make them happen. You stimulate them to happen.
What about Dr. Panamaker's assertion that people who are in the superior position because of certain conditions don't give up the superiority without violence?
Of course they don't give it up. And people here in New York, for example, don't want to give up the idea of crossing the street anytime they please. They're against the law for jaywalking. And people have to be brought into line with law, with legislation, with court control, or else we'd have chaos. And the South has to be brought in line the same way. All the good intentions of men have to be channeled. We couldn't depend on their innate good intentions. They're selfish, they're greedy, they're domineering. They want all the things for themselves. This is human beings.
Could I just pick up this point that
30 seconds.
Mr. Wilkins made? The channeling, there is, as we know, we have good intentions and bad intentions. None of us are completely heroic or completely the villain. And this is the thing that legislation, courts, leaders, political, religious, and so forth, they can, if they will, channel the good intentions towards change as we would like to see it, that is, that all people be treated with equal human dignity. Yeah. Or you can have the same leaders, or different leaders, but in the same functional position, channeling the bad intentions, bad from my particular value standard.
Well, one thing is sure, before this program began, Dr. Wortham was talking about the agreement, the degree of agreement that there would be, and he was right. But it reminds me of the fact that some time ago we did a program on a subject just like this, and the psychiatric people took precisely the opposite position. But I've got to have the last word because that's the end of the program. Thanks so much, Dr. Wortham, Dr. Panamaker, and Mr. Wilkins. We'll be back next week when we begin our program on the impact of television on American life. At that time, Richard S. Salant, Vice President of CBS Incorporated, will be one guest. Dr. Helfrich, Chief of Continuity Acceptance at NBC, will be another guest. And Professor Rule Denny, Professor of Social Sciences and co-author with David Reisman of The Lonely Crowd, will be our third guest. See you then on The Open Mind next week.
WRCA has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind is Richard D. Hefner. Mr. Hefner's guests today were Mr. Roy Wilkins, Dr. Hortense Powdermaker, and Dr. Frederick Wortham. If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, in care of the station. Roger Bowman speaking.